This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Daly. Our guest this week is Randy Russell, president of the Russell Group. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. It's coming down to the wire to November 5th in the race for the White House and for leadership of the U.S. Congress. Randy Russell, president of the Russell Group in Washington, isn't a fan of polls, but says some trends may be developing.
And something seems to have occurred, and I can't quite put my finger on it, the last couple of weeks. You look at today, the Wall Street Journal has a national poll out, has Trump up 3 points. CNBC has a national poll out this morning, again, not looking at any one specific poll, but kind of looking at trends, has Trump up 2 points nationally. There just seems to be some kind of a movement here the last couple of weeks, kind of trending towards Trump. I can't quite put my finger on it, but that just seems to be the case. And a great, I think, indication of that is some of the polling that is coming in on these Senate races in Wisconsin, in Michigan, the open seat, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio. And all of those right now are running neck and neck. So, and they have tightened considerably, where most of those are now all toss-ups. So we're just going to have to watch it. I think it's also important to point out that as of this morning, 27 million people have already voted. And we expect there to be, by Election Day, we're hearing now that as high as 60% of those that are going to vote will have voted early, and only 40% estimated now will vote actually on Election Day. So that's a trend that I think we have to watch, and how the breakdown is between Democrats and Republicans. But I would just say right now there seems to be a trend, a slight trend, and it appears to be moving in Trump's direction.
The one question that lies, that not many pay close attention to, and that there is tremendous debate, is that this is not a popular election that gives the keys to the Oval Office. It's the Electoral College. And in there lies a lot of questions about strategy for individual states moving forward.
Well, Jeff, you will recall back what happened in 2000 in the state of Florida, where we ended up having a case about ballots go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court had to make a determination about that, the so-called hanging chads. And, you know, Bush beat Gore by 573 votes in Florida and became the next president, actually a two-term president. And today we don't just have one Florida. Today we have seven Floridas. We have Arizona, we have Nevada, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, to your point. And those seven battleground states are going to very likely decide who the next president is. And if I had to pick one state to watch, Jeff, just because of the electoral count, it would be Pennsylvania. I think who wins Pennsylvania will very likely win the presidency.
Let's look at the two candidates, Trump and Harris, here in the latter days of the race. What's been their strategy, and what does that say about their effort and their ideal to gain the presidency?
Well, what they want to do here the last 2 weeks, Jeff, each is to make the closing argument for that very small slither of those that are going to vote that haven't made up their mind. That's number one. Second of all, I think even more important than that, they're going to turn their base out, because in the end, there are very few people, given these two candidates, who don't know who they're going to vote for. And it really is going to be about voter turnout. So I'd watch very closely in those seven battleground states which counties they show up in specifically and hold rallies in and events in, because the key right now is to make those closing arguments about why they should be president. But also, most importantly, I think for both of them, is turning out their base, because that'll determine who wins these key battleground states.
Is there still a battle for the suburbs, and where does the rural vote fall in this?
Well, there's obviously a huge rural-urban divide. I mean, if you go back to 2016, I think Trump got about somewhere in the neighborhood of 57% of the rural vote. I think in 2020 he bested that and got over 60%. I saw one poll recently, Jeff, in the Wall Street Journal. If you kind of look at the crosstabs on it, and it and it looked like Trump was pulling about 75% of the rural vote. That's a huge increase. Now, the issue for Trump versus Harris, Harris is going to really try to drive up and offset that through the suburban and urban vote, particularly female, because there's a huge gender gap in the suburbs between men and women. And you'll notice on some of the ads that you see, particularly in the race in the states, these battleground states that have these Senate races, you're seeing a lot of ads about abortion, and that is all about driving up turnout, particularly for suburban women, for Harris. So we'll see how that all plays out.
It doesn't appear to me that we have seen a clear platform from either candidate with regard to all of the policy right now that's important to the nation.
Jeff, you know, there's personality and there is policy. And, you know, there's a lot of people that say they won't vote for Trump because of the way, you know, they view his personality or the way he conducts himself in terms of some of the statements he makes, et cetera. I think in the case of Harris, I think in a large degree, part of her challenge has been defining herself and what her platform is separate from the Biden administration's. And after you've been vice president for nearly 4 years, how do you differentiate yourself from a unpopular a president when you were their vice president? And I think that has been a huge challenge for her. And ultimately, if she does, and I'm not predicting this, I'm saying if she does lose the election, I think part of it is that she was not able to differentiate her policies from the last 4 years.
270 agriculture groups making some statements about tariffs and trade policy, and I think it's very clear where the former president is with regard to his attitude to the rest of the world. How much attention given to tariffs here, and Randy, is that a deterrent for some voters?
I'm sure in some cases, Jeff, it is. And tariffs in and of themselves are not necessarily a good thing, and I'm certainly not advocating for them. I think one thing that people are missing, though, is to put a tariff on may be a means to an end and not an end in and of itself. What do I mean by that? I mean, Trump last time around when he was in 2016 and elected in 2016, took office in 17, used tariffs to try to get people to the negotiating table where we were running huge trade imbalances and try to get new trade deals, whether it was with China, whether it was the new form of NAFTA and USMCA, whatever it may be. And I think, frankly, there's a lot of focus on this tariff issue, and rightfully so. And if it's just tariffs to put tariffs on, I don't think that's a good thing. If it's tariffs as a means to an end to get a better trade deal, that might be something people consider. The other thing I would point out, if those numbers are true, and we'll just have to see ultimately after the election about the rural vote, despite people's concerns about tariffs, it seems like overwhelmingly there's a large number of rural Americans that are going to be supporting Trump.
When we talk about trade, last week we had Dan Bossi with Ag Resource yes. Company. And he said, we've gone from a position of being 62% of the global volume of exports down to just a little over 12% right now. Tariffs might be a plus to gain an advantage in the manufacturing sector, but we learned from tariffs the last time around, especially with China, that can be quite painful in rural America.
And I thought Dan did a great job of laying out the challenges we have, not only on tariffs, but overall how the ag economy globally is changing, and his comments particularly about the relationship between China and Brazil were spot on. And I think when you look at our ag trade deficit in a matter of about 12 years, it's gone from $37 billion surplus to a USDA estimated $42.5 billion trade deficit this year. It's just startling. And there's a lot of factors for that, but I don't think we can deny the fact that we need whoever is president to come up with a strategic plan to address this ballooning ag trade deficit and us losing market share to Brazil and others around the world.
I guess there's one thing that I would add here, and I think for myself, and I would have to believe a lot of other people in the country, I really hope that at the end of this election, on November the 5th, or at least the early morning of the 6th, that we have a clear decision with no delay?
I would like to think so. I certainly, like you, hope so. I think we'll know the outcome of the presidential race within a day or two. I think the real question will be when we know the outcome of who is in the majority versus the minority in the House of Representatives. We've got, Jeff, some really important and key races in the state of California where several Republicans that are currently in office are facing serious challenges. California has been notorious for reporting late, and it could be days, literally days. I hope that isn't the case, but I think we all ought to be prepared. It could be days, could be even into the weeks before we actually know who controls the House of Representatives because of the vote counting, particularly out west.
Well, on this program a couple of weeks ago, former Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson said he sees the House and the Senate flipping. What say you?
Well, first of all, if Colin is right, that would be the first time in this country's history. Now, think about that. First time in this country's history that the House and Senate were held by different parties and they flipped in the same election. So that would be unprecedented. I'm not suggesting it isn't going to happen. I'm just saying that is history making if indeed it happens. You know, Jeff, I honestly can't tell you. I think the House is absolutely razor thin. And it's a real toss up right now. I think the Senate is a lot more easy to predict. I think at this point, West Virginia, is clearly in the Republican. Montana, Senator Tester seems to be in a very uphill climb right now against, Sheehy. And now there are four other races that I cited earlier, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, to name four, that are toss-ups right now, all held by Democrats. So I think the Senate slot is clearly on the path at this point in my estimate to flip. And it's just, I think, now a question by what margin.
So the Ag Committee, leadership there, obviously Ms. Stabenow, did not seek re-election. She won't be back. I'm hearing Ms. Klobuchar might take the lead from the Democratic side of the aisle, and Mr. Bozeman then on the GOP side. What other changes might we see, whether it's the Ag Committee or appropriations or budget?
Well, Jeff, you know, first thing, assuming that my prediction about the Senate holds true about it flipping and going into Republican control, the first thing they will need to do is elect a leader. And they will do that shortly after they return post-Veterans Day, post-election. And there's a contest, as you know, between John Thune and John Cornyn. Thune from South Dakota, a member of the Ag Committee, and Cornyn from Texas. And that'll be the first thing that Republicans in caucus we'll have to do, so we'll watch that very closely. In terms of the Ag committees, look, I've worked a lot with Senator Stabenow, and she is a tenacious legislator and a very good legislator, and will be missed because of all the things that she has done for agriculture. She's been a leader on specialty crops. She's been a leader on so many other things. In terms of who takes over, I mean, next in line would be Sherrod Brown, who is in a tough re-election. We'll see what happens there in Ohio, but he also has the banking committee spot, and speculation is he would hold on to that. So then next in line would be Amy Klobuchar, who's obviously from a major agricultural state, being from Minnesota. And, you know, I think she'd be an outstanding either ranking member or chair, given her ties in Minnesota. Over on the House side, you know, it's G.T. Thompson and David Scott. And, you know, if the House flips, then obviously G.T. would go into the minority and David Scott would be the presumed chairman. So there will be several other committee chairs that are important given the legislative agenda for 2025. And we'll just have to watch that jockeying once we know the outcome of the election.
So let's move over to the lower chamber in the House. You've alluded to this, that it may take some time for an answer. What are the key races that we watch for here? Or I realize you said California, but are there some specific races that we watch for that may tell the tide?
Yeah, I think, you know, you've got probably both coasts are going to be really important, and then in the middle of the country. So you've got You got a couple of races in upstate New York where Republicans are currently holding seats that are going to be they're going to be very interesting to watch. But in the state of California, it's a David Valadao, a key member of the Ag Appropriations Committee, in a tough race. He's a dairyman, long ties to the agriculture community. You have Ken Calvert, a key member of the Appropriations Committee, in a tough race. And you have John Duarte, a member of the Agriculture Committee, who is also in a neck-and-neck race. So it is races like that that may very well determine who controls the House when we get back. You also have a couple of races in Iowa. Miller Meeks is one, just to keep your eye on. And there's a couple of others that are they're going to be very, very close to keep your eye on. But again, I think the state of California, if I had to pick one state, two or three races, those are the ones that I would look at.
Well, this is a real stretch for your crystal ball, given the how close the these polls are showing and the races that are ahead of us. But let's get past the election now and think about this lame duck session. Obviously, there's spending of the nation to still deal with. But after the hurricanes and after the extended drought and after the catastrophic events that have taken place, what are the chances for ad hoc disaster assistance being before the Congress and seeing some sort of out-of-budget appropriation?
Jeff, I think the probability of a disaster package is very high in a lame duck session. Look, even before we had this hurricane, significant hurricane damage and unfortunately loss of life and injury, we also had wildfires out west and other parts of the country where people were wanting disaster assistance. But I think this most recent hurricane, Helene, and the damage done by it pretty much assures we will have a disaster assistance package. And it could literally be tens of billions of dollars, very unlikely to be paid for. And I think that if you had to pick one thing that will happen during a lame duck, if I were a betting person, I'd put pretty strong money laid down on the table on there being a disaster assistance package, because I just think, given the overwhelming need for it and the demand for it, I think Congress will take that on when they get back.
Okay, now to a farm bill, either an extension or a five-year plan. Senator Grassley has said he doesn't think there's time to consider a farm bill during a regular order, and he's not interested in seeing a farm bill that he doesn't have and the committee doesn't have a hand in crafting what the next 5 years in agriculture looks like. Again, what say you?
We got the House Ag Committee that reported out a bill months ago, had four Democrats supporting it. We've yet to see any legislative text bill from the Senate Agriculture Committee, much less have a markup. Jeff, I think the probability right now of getting a long-term five-year farm bill, given we find ourselves at the end of October, and given this disaster assistance package, which is going to take an enormous amount of time, energy, and effort when Congress comes back with the lame duck, even if it lasts 4 weeks, it'll take quite a bit of the oxygen out of the room trying to get that package put together. I think the odds are diminishing by the day that we do get a five-year farm bill. Now, I will say this. There's always the possibility, though, given the low commodity prices, that some could suggest that we do some short-term ag economic assistance, taking some of the increases in reference prices and marketing loans and try to put that in as part of a disaster package. We'll just have to see if that plays out. But I just think, to be honest, the time is running out to put a bill together, to get it scored by the Congressional Budget Office, which it has to have, and to build the political support within both bodies to support that bill. I just think the clock is ticking, and we're closely coming up to the witching hour, so to speak. No pun intended with Halloween on the doorstep.
So let's go back to the conversation with Colin Peterson. First, he said this from the top. If the lead of the Senate and the lead of the House and the minority leadership, the big four in Congress, were to agree to an out-of-budget amount of money, he said this farm bill could go quickly and be done. Do you think there's the political will? Is the Farm Bill that important along with disaster assistance to see this done?
Well, Jeff, and I have the greatest respect for Colin, and he's right, but those were a lot of ifs you just outlined. I don't see the will right now on either side and either body to support some very large unpaid for additional expenditures for agriculture. If that were the case, this bill would have been done a long time ago. That's not the constraints we've been operating on. I don't think those constraints have changed. And I don't see a situation where they're going to agree to a farm bill that has increases in spending that are not offset. So I just think that that's the environment we have been operating under for 2 years. Remember, Jeff, this is a bill that was supposed to be done last year, and we had to pass an extension. And now we're at the end of 2 years and facing the strong possibility of another extension. I don't think the ground rules have changed. And I think that's just the reality we're facing.
Again, with the former chairman, I ask, okay, is it possible that you could bring disaster assistance and farm bill together into one policy? And he said that's most challenging because agriculture comes to the Ag Committee and ad hoc disaster would come through appropriations. So from what you suggested before, if we were going to come up with some economic package to support agriculture in the short run, do the two committees share ownership of such a move?
Well, let's be clear about one thing. When I talk about disaster assistance, I am talking specifically about disaster assistance for those that have suffered losses because of hurricanes and wildfires, et cetera. The ag economic assistance that I'm talking about is separate from that. And if they do decide to do that and could build support for that, I think it'd be added to the disaster assistance package. And I don't think either one of them would be paid for. And further to your question, I think it'd be a combination of both the Ag Appropriations Subcommittee and the Agriculture Committee leadership that would help shape that package because it touches both committees.
Randy, what else does the Congress have to accomplish in the lame duck session? And how much bearing now, even with ag policy, how much bearing now does this election and the potential outcomes have on ultimately what they do in that short period of time?
I think it has an enormous impact, Jeff. I think that depending upon the outcome of who wins the White House and who controls the Senate and the House will dictate whether they want to so-called clean the deck and clear the deck and pass the funding bills in an omnibus appropriations bill and fund all 12 departments and be done, and so that the new president, whoever it is, and the new Congress, the 119th session of Congress that comes back in early January, will start with that behind them. Depending upon who wins, it may be they decide they simply pass a continuing resolution to fund the government until the end of February or mid-March, deal with disaster assistance, maybe deal with the defense authorization bill, and be done. So we'll just, it directly impacts what happens in the lame duck session. I will say this though, Jeff, put 2024 aside for a second. When we look to 2025, it could be one of the most consequential years that we have had in Congress in a very long time because we have to do a tax bill, a major tax bill that impacts agriculture and so much of the rest of the economy. We are going to be dealing with trade policy. We are going to be the very first thing Congress has to do when they come back is deal with the debt ceiling, which is going to set the stage for all spending going forward. We're very likely to have a debate about trade policy. So I'm expecting, regardless of who wins in 2025, that 2025 is not only going to be very, very busy with all the new nominees from a new administration that the Senate has to consider, but the key legislation also that has to be considered, it's going to be highly consequential.
And if we don't get a farm bill in this calendar year, in this reporter's opinion, it won't be early in 25 before the wheels can turn on a farm bill.
No, it won't be, and it's the reality of it. The Senate Agriculture Committee will have to consider the nomination of a new secretary, deputy secretary, 8 undersecretaries, and others just to get in place. That's going to take an enormous amount of time, energy, and effort for them to do that. We're going to have a new ranking member or chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee. You talked about Amy Klobuchar is likely, and she will have to staff up. And so I just don't think it's realistic to think we're going to come back on January 3rd and all of a sudden, starting all over again, start moving a farm bill. Remember, too, the very first thing, as I cited, that Congress has to do in 2025 is to pass a debt ceiling bill. And we're running a $36 trillion total debt. We're going to spend more this year on interest on the debt than we are on defense spending, which is just a shocking statistic. That's just to pay the interest on the debt, Jeff. That isn't reducing the debt at all. So I think that's going to set the tone and tenor of much of what is done in 2025, and taking a farm bill out in that environment is going to be difficult.
Well, Randy Russell, thank you for your time today and your insight. Obviously, the election is in the hands of the voters, and we'll see the outcome, and then we'll deal with the consequences as a result. It's Open Mic, Randy, and today you've got the last word on this discussion.
Well, Jeff, thanks, as always, for the great job you do. I think the Open Mic segment is a real service to our community. And all I would say is I encourage people to vote. And regardless of what the outcome is, I hope our community can rally together and come back next year in 2025. And if we don't get a farm bill done this year, get it done next year.
Our thanks to Randy Russell, president of the Russell Group, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Soy Checkoff. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.